This week, we welcome Ben Carr, Chief Information Security Officer at Aristocrat. In the Leadership and Communication segments, how to make sure your board sets a good example for your company, cybersecurity is putting customer trust at the center of competition, 6 reasons your home office is better than your company office, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly. The modern attack surface is vast and permeable, extending from the data center to the cloud and device edge. Security teams are stretched thinner and thinner as they try to cover this ground. The result? More high-profile breaches hit the news every day. Don't let your organization be next. ExtraHop delivers security from the inside out, helping enterprise security teams detect threats up to 95% faster and cut staff time to resolve by 2/3 or more. Act with confidence. Learn more at extrahop.com/securityweekly. Today's determined attackers easily bypass even the most advanced network defenses. Trying to ramp up staff to detect their backdoors can cost thousands of dollars and take months, even years. With Active Countermeasures AI Hunter, we enable junior analysts to detect even the most advanced backdoors in a matter of hours. Sign up for a demo and purchase our product today by visiting activecountermeasures.com/PSW. Active Countermeasures. Make every analyst a hunter. Are you worried about PCI compliance? Does your development team understand or care about security? Are you ready to face a breach of your customer's sensitive data? See the worst that can happen before it does. Black Hills Information Security can help you help management see the future. Email consulting@blackhillsinfosec.com to find out how a web application penetration test can mitigate the risk before you go live.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 120, recorded March 11th, 2019. I am your host, Matt Alderman, finally back in the state of Colorado, joined by my co-host, Paul Asadorian in G-Unit Studio in Rhode Island.
Welcome. Thanks, Matt. What's going on?
Oh, what a week last week. So just getting caught up.
Matt, it sounds like your audio is cutting in and out.
It's interesting.
Not sure why.
Hopefully it's not my internet connection. My 1 gig fiber connection was supposed to be better than...
Anyway, what's going on?
All right. OSHIN is hosting Rhode Island Cybersecurity Exchange Day on March 13th at the O'Hare Academic Building at Salve Regina in Newport, Rhode Island. Register now at oshin.org/events. That's OSHEAN.org. Also, join us April 1st to 3rd at Disney's Contemporary Resort for InfoSec World 2019. Visit infosecworld.misty.com/security-weekly and use the registration code OS19-SecWeek for 15% off the main conference or World Pass. We will be recording at InfoSec World 2019. If you are interested in booking an interview or a briefing with Security Weekly, please visit securityweekly.com/conference-request to learn more. All right, let's start with our guest. Ben Carr is the Chief Information Security Officer at Aristocrat. Prior to Aristocrat, Ben was VP of Strategy for Cyberbit and North America's Technical Director for Tenable. Obviously, we worked together in the past. Prior to Tenable, Ben was Senior Director, Global Information Security at Visa and Head of Global Corporate IT Security at Nokia. Ben has also served on advisory boards for Mimecast, Qualys, Accuvant, and SentinelOne. Ben, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Good seeing you, man.
Yeah, good being here.
So a little history for everybody. Ben was at Visa when I was running VP of Strategy at Tenable, and we were looking at hiring out kind of field CTOs, what we call technical directors, to really help enable the field with sales and kind of vision and strategy and all those other things. So I brought Ben over, and we worked together for a number of years at Tenable before you now ended up in
Aristocrat. I was going to say, Ben, you look really familiar now. Okay, that's why.
Yeah, a blast from the past.
That's right.
And Matt, we've known each other since I was at Nokia, actually, right?
Way back in the day. Yeah, I think I was at Accuvant or Qualys. I think I was at Accuvant at the time
Yeah.
So give everybody a little intro because your background's interesting, right? I mean, you Nokia and Visa, obviously, in security mm-hmm. roles. You went to the vendor side for a little bit. Now you're back in a CISO role. Kind of give us help everybody kind of understand those transition points.
Yeah, so it feels a little weird saying way back in the day because it is way back in the day now. But I actually started out in the IT side, running kind of operations in regular IT, and then decided at one point to go over to the vendor space. So I worked for McAfee for a while, and that's how I actually got into security, and then worked for quite a few vendors up until this point where I went over and worked for Nokia and ran security for them globally after about 4 years. And then went over to Visa. So really transitioned over to Visa, just really interesting environment, interesting problem to solve from a security aspect. Most people think of Visa as a financial, but really more of a technology company. And so from that technology factor, actually securing the infrastructure and securing the network for Visa, really kind of one of their core competencies, and one of the things that was really core to the business proposition, right? As you can imagine, if confidence in Visa was removed from a large incident, that could severely impact the brand. So that's how I got over there. But after having been at Visa for about 4 years, really decided that it was time to move on, do something else. And we had the discussions around you being at Tenable and what Tenable was doing, really believed in the vision and strategy with where Tenable was going. So went back over to the vendor space for a while, right? Did about 2 years at Tenable. Really good experience for me. Moved on to take a larger role as a VP of strategy right before Tenable went public. And then just decided I wanted to get back in the internal space, right? I wanted to run a program somewhere, wanted to actually implement a lot of the strategy and direction that I had been a believer in. And so took this role. And now here at Aristocrat, running global information security for public company. We're doing business in over 300 regulatory environments, over 90 countries, global footprint, 5 different business units. It's really exciting place to be, and so really getting to implement security the right way.
So I don't think many people know Aristocrat. Unless you're in the gambling industry.
It's not a well-known brand outside of the industry, I think, right?
I thought it's not coffee.
That's true. A lot of people probably know Aristocrat, but don't know Aristocrat in the sense that Aristocrat's in the gaming space. And by gaming, I mean actual casino gaming and also the digital arena. So Aristocrat's been around for quite some time, Australian-based public company. But we're we're in the EGM space, electronic gaming machines. So when you go to Vegas, when you go to a casino and you play a slot machine, there's high odds that you're probably playing on one of our machines. So
now, Ben, do you compete or have ever competed with a company called IGT? Used to be GT.
Yes.
Okay.
Same space.
Now I know the name from I used to work for when it was then GTech here in Rhode Island. Okay. Yeah. So.
Yeah, exactly. So we, class 3, right, which is casino, typical casino gaming, and then also class 2. So we're a very big presence in the class 2, which is more tribal casinos, mm-hmm. That type of gaming. So really from a lot of its tax basis.
Now, including Foxwoods out here in the Northeast.
Yep.
I was just correct. Spent the night there with my family.
Yeah, very nice casino. I've been there a couple times.
It is nice, yeah.
Yeah, and then we realized that there's only so much so many new casinos being developed and going up. So one of the things for us to look at how to expand the brand and how to expand the business is we dove into the digital space. And so we acquired a company called Big Fish Games, a company called Product Madness, and a company called Polarium. And so they're part of our portfolio of companies and really in the freemium and pay to play space inside of iPads, iPhones, Android.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
Well, that's cool.
So you're in this interesting space, right? You make gaming machines. You've got all these digital gambling kind of game component. Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges you face from a security perspective? Not only, I guess, what you're challenged with today, but also some of those things that are unique to you a little bit.
Yeah, so I think, especially coming from a market like a company like Visa, in that market space, it's highly regulated. And when you talk to people here in our business, they think of this business as highly regulated. But from a security perspective, it's not really that highly regulated. We don't face PCI, SOX, HIPAA, GLBA. Like, there's not really a ton of regulatory compliance that then mandates a set of security controls. So we're really trying to implement security because it's the right thing to do for the business and manage against the risk, versus a lot of other industries where you're actually, I guess, buoyed up by the fact that there's compliance controls that are, I guess, the baseline for your security program, right? So there's a good and a bad to that. I think also we're dealing with two very traditionally different businesses. What we call our land business or the casino business is really about making machines that we then sell to a casino or we lease to a casino. And so they're on site. And as you know, if you think about the footprint and what we're looking at from a security perspective, you know, there's not a lot of forward-facing stuff. It's more protecting the core infrastructure.
But yeah, then, Ben, I was going to ask you a question about that, because when I was designing secure network security for lottery networks, which is very different from a gaming.
We also do that as well. We participate in the lottery side too.
Yeah, so we could have interesting conversations. I don't think on air is probably the right place to talk about how securing the lottery. but in terms of on the casino floor, I mean, do you basically sell them the machine and then the security that they implement in their network is all them? Or do you also consult with some of the casinos to help them with their security? Say, look, you bought this machine. Here's typically how it's secured.
Yeah, good question. So you can think about it on the casino floor. It's really selling a device, right? But we've also entered into, there was a law change several years ago that allowed actually machines to be leased. So if you think software as a service for casino gaming, right? Mm-hmm. We basically host the machine and there's a revenue sharing model in place there for that. Right. But typically the traditional businesses sell them a box and it's on the, you know, on the casino floor, and their security is essentially responsible for that. And, you know, the connectivity to the device doesn't really affect the back end game system, right? Mm-hmm. There's not as much concern in that arena. We certainly do have security concerns around the security of the manufactured product, mm-hmm. but it's not, you know, when it's on the floor, it's really up to the casino security to protect, you know, the security of someone accessing that device.
Right. Yeah. So what you're saying is that you're not putting a whole bunch of research and development into securing the physical device and making it tamper-proof. I'm sure you do some of those things. But yes, a casino, right. I mean, is covered in cameras and people on the floor. So the opportunity attacker would have to tamper with a device, they'd be spotted.
Yeah,
pretty
quickly. You think about the security investment for any one casino. Right. I mean, it's immense, right? So it's a much different perspective there.
And to give you an example, I went up to the bar actually at the local casino, a local in Connecticut, right? And I said, I want two drinks, one for me and one for my wife. He's like, no, one drink per person. There has to be another person here. And I'm like, well, my wife's up in the room with three kids. He's like, dude, I hear you. He's like, but there's cameras. If I serve you two drinks, everywhere. Like, I'm done. I'm like, I don't want to get you in trouble. We'll figure something out, right?
Yeah. I wish I had those eyes on, right? We don't have that level of visibility. Mm-hmm. So, but that, and then that's, you know, you ask the, you know, where things are unique to us. Then that's, I think from our business perspective, that's the divide, is that there's that perception for, I guess, the land-based business, our mm-hmm. casino business. And then there's a much different perception and the footprint of what's customer-facing and what's internet-facing from a digital perspective, mm-hmm. hugely different, right? I mean, all those assets are then, you know, on the internet, digital-facing, apps on iPads, apps on, you know, iPhones and Android devices around the world. So mm-hmm. that exposure and the amount of information we have. So we don't really have the information on the customers in the same way that we do in the digital space, right? In the land business, the casinos own that data and the casinos own the interaction with the end customers. And in the digital space, we own that interaction. So it's almost like having two different business models that you're trying to deal with and figure out how to best secure those and how to make the, you know, the decisions around implementations and security. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you have specific challenges from a manufacturing perspective of the physical land-based device. Get it?
Yes.
But then, to your point, I'm now dealing with users, privacy, data, everything else up in the digital space, completely different set of concerns that you now have to be aware of and protect on that side of the business.
Yeah, it really is almost two different businesses, right? But there's a blend, you know, trying to take like intellectual property that we have on those casino games mm-hmm. and figure out how to bring that into the digital space, as well as, you know, you can imagine the digital is a lot more fluid. So being able to look at the IP we have in the digital space and how we can gain information and insights to transition that into you know, the more physical world of that land-based casino business to produce more popular games. So, I mean, there's definitely a cross population, but it's a unique challenge to try to figure out how to secure those two different environments, you know, with essentially one budget.
It's interesting, Ben, when I was working in gaming, there was kind of a transition, and actually Linux was being used in some of the gaming devices, mm-hmm. Versus like a real-time OS that like nobody had any idea what it was. Like, it was really obscure, sometimes written by the actual gaming company itself before there was a lot of, you know, forget, like the company I worked for was in business for 30 plus years before I got there. So they would like write their own operating systems for the gear. And that was, you know, still there when I was there. But as we transition some of these devices, perhaps to more accessible operating systems, does that increase the security requirements in your mind?
It does. You know, I think anytime you build on a closed system, there's pros and cons to that, mm-hmm. right? So there's the concept of security by obscurity, where, you know, that no one really knows that closed system. But then, you know, typically in a closed system, you're not getting as much review. And so the potential for security issues are always there. Right. We've certainly moved to that more open system standpoint of either, you know, Linux or, you know, Windows based environment, which, you know, really surprised me actually that some of these things are actually, you know, Windows based. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the same thing here from a history perspective, going out to corporate, you'll see, you know, actual games that were, you know, physical machines, right? There's really not any OS or software behind them. They're really physical. And so transitioning that whole transitional and life cycle and moving into that, now coming full circle to where we're trying to figure out how do we produce games that are really a lot more open and a little and easily transitionable from either that physical to digital or digital to physical.
Right, right. Yeah, there was some of that. Like, you know, they develop a game and then I think, Ben, what you're saying is right, that moves to different platforms. That could end up in an app, that could end up on a website, right? And we had different countries that had different laws about where you could do gaming and how you could do gaming, and they would take shape in those various markets.
Yeah, and that's a big piece of it, is the regulatory environment and how you determine that shapes a lot of our industry, right? So what can you put in the cloud? What's publicly accessible? What has to be in a casino floor? Jurisdictional issues, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't operate that outside of a jurisdiction. So I think from a gaming perspective, a lot of these companies would like to figure out how to move that off the casino floor into a more accessible environment. But that just isn't possible due to the regulations. There was just a change made last year around sports betting, right? So I think everybody's trying to figure out how to get into the, you know, the digital sports betting side of the house. So it's an evolving industry, and it's something that's been traditionally, I think, a lot more controlled by local regulation. And with the, you know, with the internet, it's just become something that people are trying to figure out how do they consume it in this new paradigm.
And it's interesting, by regulation, we're not talking about security guidelines at all, right?
These
are all regulations surrounding gaming.
Yeah. So when we say highly regulated environment, we mean if you want to ship a device to a casino in, you know, making something up here, but a casino in Oklahoma, you know, it has to go from the manufacturing floor to the casino in a truck with nothing else on that truck. So you can't just put it in a FedEx truck and ship it. Mm-hmm. That's an example of like gaming regulations, right? Or just, you know, personally, like if you have to go for a review to make sure that your background check meets gaming requirements, right? Mm-hmm. All of our specific individuals in the company have to go through gaming regulatory approval and then have a gaming license, right? And so from that perspective, that has no bearing really on security. I mean, you could lightly draw some conclusions about it, but there's no specific requirement that says you must do scanning on a weekly basis. You must have, you know, intrusion detection system. You must be doing CASB.
And is it company policy or regulation, or maybe a mixture, that says you can't play any games, right? I'm sure you have that. I had that restriction. Like, I couldn't, if I did play the lottery, I couldn't win.
It's a mix. So there's some things that I think are just burdened by the fact that there's regulation that says if you're in this jurisdiction, you're not allowed to. There's other things that just company policy to make it easy for employees to understand what the regulations are with all the different gaming jurisdictions.
Right.
And it's funny, you can play someone else's machines, but we can't play our own machines. So.
Right, right. Yeah. Exactly.
It's kind of like helping out the competition, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What are some of the solutions you're looking for as you think about your environment? And I think most of it's probably on the digital side, but what are some of those solution areas where you still need some help? I'm curious where you're trying to solve problems in your environment today.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has been core blocking and tackling and buoying up the security controls that we have, putting things in place that make sense for a new environment. So things like how do we do business across multiple companies well? So single unified identity and how we access those that transact information securely back and forth between the organization, but as well externally, right? Sharing that data. So, I think back in my history to like rights management, trying to implement that. So, we could share data securely with external vendors. It's not really done that well. It's done well internally when you're federated internally, but it's not done when you start wanting to deal with a lot of third parties. Trying to figure out how to implement real good development security. So, as we move into containers and Dockers and trying to figure out how to make that extensible and really make sure that security is left in the cycle, less costly to the business, and how we're able to take those business concerns about speed to production and speed to development, but still make that production and that life cycle a secure life cycle. I think that's really the biggest thing from a digital side and where I think we don't have solutions yet.
So you hit two of my favorites, identity and application. I'm sure you've got some data aspects too, from a privacy perspective and other things also. But I mean, you definitely outlined two of the ones that I figured, have to be kind of there in this new digital transformation kind of environment.
Yeah. And it's funny. We've been talking about identity for so long, right? I mean, I remember back when I was at Nokia, when we first started interacting, I mean, that was one of the big challenges we had there was how do you handle identity, not just internally, but also, again, with all the business people you need to interact with and the business partners, and how do you utilize that identity in a secure, safe, and trustable manner? And I still don't think it's been solved in a great way yet, right? I think there's still a lot of solutions, and I still think the market's somewhat fragmented. So, if you go to somebody who's a great IDP provider, but they don't actually offer a great PAM solution, right? And so we're trying to piece that whole puzzle together for identity, and they don't have a great way to federate with externals. And then how do we also tie that back to the identities that we issue for our customer base? How do we ensure that that's good? And then that bleeds into that data piece that you provided is like, how do we manage that only the people who are supposed to access that data are accessing that data, and how do we transact and track that data through the environment, through the life cycle of the data? I mean, GDPR has just been crazy from, a right to be forgotten, having to give somebody information on what we have about them in a specific period of time. I mean, that's just really hard, especially in the digital space, as people stand up and drop identities very quickly.
Yeah, I can imagine. I've been saying the same thing in identity, right? It's too fragmented. There's an opportunity to bring more capabilities into a single platform to make it easier for companies that are struggling with this, not only mm-hmm. internally, but also all that external connectivity, because we talk a lot about the shift of the perimeter to the person and the application, and identity and identity solutions are going to be a big part of how you control that kind of emerging perimeter. And that's where I'd like to see a lot more innovation and bringing things together in an easier way.
Or even, the crossing of identity platforms, right? So one of the problems we're having right now is we're looking for some things in an MSSP world. And, you talk to the MSSP and they've standardized on an identity provider. But then, does that match the same identity provider that we have? If not, do they allow multiple identity providers to connect? How does that work if, we're using a solution that they are hosting, but we want access to that as well, and their identity provider isn't the same as our identity provider? I mean, the inability to use multiple identity providers to access one service, I mean, that starts to break a lot of the interactions and the collaboration that we want to have with people. So I just don't think that somebody's have a great solution for a real strategic enterprise way to solve this. I think it's very single centric point of view on this, and that's harmful, I think, to the industry.
Yeah, agreed. So give us an idea, Ben, what's your structure internally? Who do you report to? How often are you in front of the board, etc.? I'm just for others? Because we see the CISO role report to various places in the organization. Where are you at in the org?
Yeah, so I report to the CIO, who reports up to the CEO. And so from that perspective, it's a rather typical alignment, I would say. I've seen the same thing as you. People report into legal. I've seen people report into other areas of the organization as well. I think ultimately, I think the CISO role long term, and I think we've seen this for some organizations already, I think that that's going to be a much more, need to be a much more direct report up to the CEO or to, you know, to the board, because that line of communication, it's really important that you have that dialogue back and forth to be able to have an honest discussion about the state of the state and where things are. And I think the responsibility as we move further and further into that digital space, it's just going to be really more important to have that dialogue and that communication.
So are you having that dialogue today? Kind of how often are you having that dialogue?
Yeah, some. So, I mean, I have an open channel to the CEO if I need to, if I need to have a communication there. Although I think, you know, just functionally not having that direct report, it puts a layer in there between there. But that, I think that's expected. A lot of companies that are going through, the maturity phases that we are. I think to be able to consume that data and have that discussion is something that takes time. I communicate with the board probably on a quarterly basis. Certainly our executive steering committee on a quarterly basis or more often, depending upon when they need updates or when I have something to communicate. I have access. It's just, trying to get to the point where we can consume that information in a relevant fashion where it's understood. And so it's, I think, contextualizing a lot of that information as we build the program and build the maturity.
Yeah. So I assume you're still kind of working through some of those metrics and measurements that you want to share with the board and your executive committee as you're evolving the program, right? So, that takes some time too.
Yeah. So this was security before I came here was a part of IT, right? So this is the first CISO role that Aristocrat has had. And so part of that was building foundationally what the role should do, how it interacted with the organization, then to building out a team. So I built out my direct reports at this point. We're further building out. So a plug for us, if anybody's looking for a role, we've got a number of individual contributor roles we'll be posting very shortly here. Trying to complete out the team and build out the org structure internally to support that. But part of that is I just hired a person, actually came from one of the organizations in Las Vegas, to handle GRC. And so building out that risk and governance function and being able to generate the right report data. I think one of the things that people fail at in this role is sending up the wrong data. Communication with the board, with the steering committee, and with the CEO, it's really important to put the right context on that data. And I think what you communicate and how you motivate people really is important to get the end result you want. And so if you put up the wrong metrics, if you say, we have this large number of vulnerabilities, does that really help anybody out contextualize it? It's always, a red flag that you're sending up. And I think sometimes it's important to say, we have a large number of vulnerabilities, but contextually the risk to our organization is X. And it's not as high as what you would necessarily perceive by just the number of vulnerabilities. Same thing, like what do you consider an incident and what isn't an incident? What is just, an event that happened, but it was triaged and handled and so never really turned into an incident? I think we've got to be careful, especially in this role as a CISO, and being able to contextualize the right information for the consumers of the data. That way they can understand how they're supposed to respond to it as opposed to just a mountain of information, which they don't understand how to take in and how to contextualize for themselves.
Yeah, tying those metrics back to a set of business goals and then trying to communicate the alignment to those goals is more of a business risk discussion than it is a sheer volume of vulns, incidents, missing patches, et cetera. There has to be context so the business knows how to consume it and make decisions on how to either mitigate or transfer or accept risk.
Yeah, I mean, whenever you're communicating with my peers or with the CEO or the board, I think the ask is like, what do you want the business to do? What's the objective you're looking for that we're going to achieve? And so, if you just send a bunch of data up there, there's not really a business context to that. And I think you're asking people who have really little to no concept of security, right? In our world, I mean, I think they have a layperson's, but this is, you know, definitely a specialized skill. When you're asking someone to contextualize and take that in, you're overwhelming them. They don't know how to respond. But if you can put it in a business context so they understand like what you're asking, this is a specific level of risk. We're asking from this from the business, whether it's resource dollars, a change in a business process, what's the impact to the business as a result of that, then the discussions become a lot cleaner. I think when we don't do that, it's a much more difficult discussion. And that's when we see people failing at I think these roles and even lower. I mean, I'm asking my directs to think in business context and think in business terms.
That's good. That's great. Any tips, recommendations for others looking to move into a CISO role?
It's not easy. It's challenging, right? I think the first thing is, you know, you've got to have the right background and skills. You have to have a little bit of diversity there. You know, if you come up through one piece of the security org, I think it's not necessarily as easy to move into that role. I think you have to bring a different background. And so one of the things that was beneficial to me is actually I wasn't in, you know, the internal IT security space for my whole career. I had kind of the vendor side of it, exposure to a lot of different technologies, as well as being on the sales side of it, right? And actually interacting with a lot of different customers to understand their pain points and understand, you know, again, some of what that business context and issues were, even though maybe they weren't expressing it themselves. And so I think having that varied background was helpful for me in positioning myself as being able to interact with the business, being able to understand what their issues were. And then the CISO role is a sales role. I mean, it just really is when it comes down to it. And I don't mean that in a you know, used car salesman way. I mean it in a, you know, you have to position what your objectives and what you're trying to achieve are, put it in a way that makes sense for the business, and you have to sell that solution. So at the end of the day, when it comes down to the discussion about dollars and resources, you're able to get the dollars and resources you need to be successful in your program. And so I think those are the things that that companies are looking for. Keep trying. Don't give up. If you're not finding the role you want, don't stay in a job that you're not happy with, that's not making you happy. At the end of the day, people talk about work-life balance, but I think if you're not happy in the work piece of that balance, then ultimately your life piece is gonna suffer. So, I mean, I'm a firm believer in making sure that you're doing what you're happy with, and that'll lead to success in the end.
Yeah, take an SE role and go outbound for a little bit and then come back inside, maybe just to give you the kind of that variation.
It doesn't hurt. I mean, yeah, people, I think often in the internal side, they don't want to, you know, they look at vendors with a little bit of disdain sometimes, right? Or as a meal ticket, you know, a good lunch, good dinner now and then. But I think it's a different perspective. And I think you get exposed to a lot more of the environment and a lot more of the challenges that we deal with on a day-to-day side internally. I mean, if you've spent your whole career in two companies over, you know, 20 years internally, your perspective is going to be pretty narrow, right? I mean, you've got to get out there and see what's going on in the environment.
Yeah. Especially in this world where we're constantly evolving, right? Technology's changing, shifting of deployment strategies. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. And if you don't have some of that exposure, you don't always understand the challenges outside of what you know, which may be a very narrow view.
Yeah, and I think also like one of the things that I've seen this advice before, and I've taken it to heart a little bit, is like, don't be afraid to get out of your comfort zone. I mean, if you're always saying, looking at a role and saying, hey, I don't know if I'm ready for that CISO role yet. I mean, you're never going to be ready for your first CISO role. It is definitely a shift, right? That is one of the, I guess, the things that was I expected, but it was more so than I guess, you know, you can prepare for, is that the level of responsibility and the decisions that you have to make are at a much different level than if you're reporting to a CISO, right? Or if you're a senior director at a public company. It just becomes a different level of impact, and you don't have somebody to go to and say, what do you think? It's all on you. So you're going to have to step outside of your comfort zone. So if you're not ready for that, step out of your comfort zone a little bit now, like take on some other responsibility, some other role, get involved with the business further. And I think in general, just getting involved with the business and trying to understand, you know, because at this level, the questions aren't like, how should we be secure? The questions are, how do we do the right thing for the business from a risk perspective? And so that business level discussion is something you've got to figure out how to answer.
Yeah, agreed. Paul, do you have any more questions for Ben?
I do not. I enjoyed the discussion about lottery and gaming. It was fun.
Yeah, we should have an offline discussion about that sometime. Absolutely. Paul. And it'd be interesting to pick your brain.
Cool.
Ben, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly. We'll take a quick break and then cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
Effectively securing your organization and its reputation requires a smarter approach. To maximize efficiency and minimize risk, security experts turn to LogRhythm, the only leading solution built solely for security teams by a security team committed to your success. With next-gen SIEM, user and entity behavior analytics, network traffic and behavior analysis, security automation and orchestration, and compliance, LogRhythm provides security made smarter. How do you use the information from this show to address issues that executives actually care about? TrustedSec is a global information security consulting firm built on cutting-edge attack simulation research that extends those insights to advisory services, including governance, risk, and compliance, PCI, virtual CISO, and MITRE attack framework assessments. TrustedSec helps you translate the types of zeros and ones that you care about to the types of zeros and ones that executives care about. Go to TrustedSec.com/securityweekly. Learn how TrustedSec can become an extension of your team.
Major data security breaches continue to make headlines. Are you prepared? Standardizing your security framework will help you stay competitive, be a reliable business partner, and manage intellectual property, financials, and employee and customer information. The American National Standards Institute, or ANSI, offers the standards you need in one place through standard subscriptions, a cost-saving, fully customizable solution. Learn more at securityweekly.com/ANSI. Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Paul Asadorian. Secure World Boston is hosting their 15th annual conference, March 27th and 28th at the Heinz Convention Center. Security Week listeners save $100 off a full conference pass by visiting secureworldexpo.com and using the discount code SecurityWeekly. Also, we just released our 2019 Security Weekly 25 Index Survey. Please go to securityweekly.com and click the survey link to help us understand who's evaluating, using, or formally used any of the Security Weekly 25 companies. The results will be summarized and presented back to all responders in a private webcast. All right, Paul, let's dig into the articles this week.
Let's do it.
All right, so we've had a couple weeks. We had RSA last week. So I picked out a set of articles for this week. There's probably a couple we'll go over the next couple weeks. But we were talking to Ben Carr on the last segment and CISOs, and we talked a little bit about the board. And so Harvard Business Review has this article about how to make sure your board sets a good example for your company. And this article is focused on the CEO, but I think valuable for CISOs or anybody who has to present to the board on kind of making sure you've got stuff kind of organized and ready to go. So I dug into this one a little bit. It was kind of fun. So the first one that I thought was good, and I think this applies to CISOs as well, is share expectations, agree on principles, and put them in writing so that there's a plan. It's the plan of, you know, if you're sitting at the board and you're the CISO and you're setting a plan for the year, you know, make sure everybody's kind of share those expectations, figure out what you're going to do, and then put it in action. And that helps you prepare and plan really for the rest of the year on how your communications with the board will be.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's important to have things in writing just so everyone knows, you know, what the plan is, and literally everyone's on the same page, right? That's important.
Yeah. Agreed. There's, you know, obviously review them on an annual basis. You know, plans are going to change. Every year you're going to set a new set of business goals. Those goals may change expectations at the board level. Mm-hmm. So those have to be reviewed and adjusted. There's a couple here that are very CEO specific, but it talks about, you know, performance reviews, annual board self-assessments, just some of those basic things that we kind of do at layers in the organization, but what they're saying is do those at the board as well.
Right.
And make sure you're addressing kind of all the members on the board and making sure expectations and performance are set and evaluated.
Mm-hmm.
This one ties into our next article, which is, I'd love to tie these articles together. After a breach, CISOs fall on their swords or play the role of scapegoat. We've seen lots of examples of this. They talk about Target and Uber and Expedia hack, right? Mm-hmm. And how, you know, you change out your CISO or a bunch of executives and kind of move forward. And what the article's talking about here is, look, you have to have a relationship with security. Security has to be tied in with the board. Security has to understand business objectives. And if they're going to be effective in mitigating a breach, they have to be a business partner with the rest of the executive team. They can't be the scapegoat or the guy that gets fired just because there's an event, because it's more than security. Can't sit in a bubble. It can't sit by itself. It has to be integrated in, and you've got to address it as a holistic company thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it has to, as we always say, align with the business, right?
Yeah, exactly right. And if you've got your board set and security's part of that discussion, then you're working together through breaches. It's not
right. Yeah.
A scapegoat.
I completely agree. And we cover breaches all the time, right? And I don't want to do the name and shame game for the security departments in those organizations, because most of the time it's really not their fault. Usually it's some other systemic problem, right? And I think CISOs carry too much of the burden there. I think you're right, Matt. When it comes down to business decisions, they should be making those together. And when you're breached, we go, either we miss something, which is totally possible in today's day and age, right? Which you have to take that into consideration. And then the other thing is, you know, did they accept the risk with the business leaders? So when you get breached, you said, look, like, we accepted this risk, and now it's time we accept the consequences of accepting that risk, and there's a breach, and let's make sure we can respond to it, right? There's always some type of security incident that's going to happen in the organizations. You're not going to prevent all of them. You have to have a plan for dealing with them. And I think firing people is the wrong thing. Even if it was a failure in their department, that's an opportunity to be even better and learn from your failures. And I would rather have a CISO as part of my organization that had been at companies that had been hacked and had to deal with that than not.
Yeah, because you're going to learn from those mistakes. Yeah. And hopefully you're putting plans in place to mitigate it in the future. Mm-hmm. And so those folks, they've been there. They've gone through yeah. that battle. So they know exactly some of the things they would change or do differently to protect mm-hmm. the organization.
For sure.
Yeah. I love this next article on cybersecurity is putting customer trust at the center of competition. Finally. Mm. And it talks about two major trends, right? It's talking about the trends of everybody's a software company now. Mm-hmm. You know, as we move through this digital transformation, we're interacting with software, and then you have that expanse of people interacting with your software. And that now requires you to start to build trust as part of your story, because now I got to protect customer data, privacy, mm-hmm. all these other things that we've been talking about for years. But it sounds like companies are really embracing the trust aspect of their solutions, and cybersecurity is playing a role in building that trust to protect these customers and these clients, whoever, in the interaction with other companies. And they talk about Apple in this article mm-hmm. and kind of the philosophies behind Apple and what Tim Cook has done to really try to build trust across the Apple environment and how that has benefited Apple as a company.
Right.
So for those people out there, trust, build trust in your products.
I think we have seen, and I think a few guests have pointed that out recently, that there has been a trend towards trust and it being part of the brands, especially of major companies. And we know major companies have very large security teams, and sometimes they're using that as part of their marketing for whatever the product is, right? I was talking to someone, and we were talking about the trust that you have in your financial institutions, right? I think that very heavily weighs in on if you're going to do some kind of stock or investment transaction, you have to have a certain degree of trust, and that involves security. So they have to reassure their customers that your account and your transactions will be secure. Otherwise, we're going to go take our investments and transactions to a different company. Matt and I were just evaluating this specific example, and security definitely plays into it, right? If they don't, at the very basic, require some kind of login security, authentication type of security, I mean, they're out, right? So
yeah, I mean, I want to see two-factor authentication on my bank accounts.
Right.
I'm not a big fan of banking mobile apps yet. I don't. Mm-hmm. I really don't trust them yet. I haven't seen enough there to really trust them. So I'm like, look, I'm just going to interact with my banking environment, two-factor authentication. Yep. It forces me to put it in the second token. Then I know it's secure. But trust goes, it's beyond that too, Paul. I mean, we've talked about trust internally and building trust with our analytics, the decisions we're going to make. That eventually enables things around automation. There's a trust component there for any of the security companies that are out there thinking about automation and level of trust. We've seen companies like Microsoft be very transparent over the last number of years with vulnerabilities and patches that have built broader trust with the Microsoft ecosystem and environment over the years. I mean, so you've seen it in a lot of different places. That's going to allow these companies to continue to thrive and grow as they build those relationships with their customers, whether you're a vendor to a set of companies or whether you're somebody like Apple who's providing, you know, mobile devices and lots of services to a broad customer base. I had to bring this article in, this next one, because this was last night for me. Five simple things to do every Sunday night to prepare for the weekend, for the week ahead. And this is where I get in trouble, right? We were at RSA all last week. Crazy, crazy week. You know, you're just buried when you get back. And I'm like, oh, shoot, I have two shows today. I got to do prep.
Right.
And I use Sundays as a way to prepare for the week ahead. Normally, I would do show prep on Fridays and only a few tweaks on a Monday morning, for example. But this Sunday was a little more work to get ready, because we were because with RSA last week. But it's just some good tips. It talks about, getting what'd you already finish? Good. You know what you got done last week. That's kind of a no-brainer. But it's really about organizing, what do you have to do for the week ahead? And kind of know the logical order things have to be done. For me, it's this show. BSW is the first big thing I have to prep for Mondays. And so I want to make sure I have that one done. And then if we're doing another show or I'm co-hosting on another show, that's kind of secondary, and then all the other activities. So very important to kind of get my stuff organized for the week. But it talks about input, not output. It's not saying do a bunch of work on Sunday. Sometimes it's just saying, look around, understand all the things you have to do. You don't have to work on a Sunday. That's where I think my wife gets most upset with me, is when I spend too much time working on a Sunday. It's supposed to be more family time on Sunday. But taking those inputs and just making sure you're prepared for the week is what I took out of this article. And I do it a lot just because of the way our Mondays always line up.
Yeah, for sure. I think that the preparation can happen in any. So I use my time on flight and in between flights to do some of the prep for this week. Again, knowing when you've been traveling and you're out, especially activity we generated at RSA. I was in the airport, you saw it, Matt, in between flights. I was we need to have meetings, right? And I was scheduling the meetings for the upcoming week, knowing what we had on our plate for that week. So yeah, getting ahead and planning like that is super, super helpful.
Plus, you also told me all the people you didn't get to that I had to follow up on Thursday.
Before yes, I went exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So almost Friday morning by the time I left San Francisco.
Right. Yeah. Setting expectations and, having a plan for when you get back, especially if you've been busy at a conference like we have, talking to the people that work for you or work with you and letting them know what the plan is really important. and setting the priority too. Matt and I had a lot of conversations of, I had a lot of ideas coming off of RSA, just, you know, creative spark that happens when you go to a conference. What's the most important thing, right? Like, let's pick one thing. And I think we talked about a Warren Buffett article that said that, right?
Yep.
And that was kind of the basis of our conversation. Actually, I was driving in the car on Friday to go on vacation with my family. And I was like, man, I got a lot of ideas. But I think the one thing to think about this weekend, if this is our one thing, this is what we should do. So,
yeah, there was another article I almost threw in here because it's similar to that article we did, yeah. which is saying no.
Yeah.
The ability to say no. I think the other one is Steve Jobs says saying no to 1,000 things drives innovation, right?
Yep.
Because sometimes you get distracted by all the other things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you boiled it down to, if we can do one thing, this is the one thing after RSA. So yeah, that's where our focus will be, not the other 10 or so ideas that came
right?
out of
exactly.
last week.
Well, yeah. you know, I earned the nickname the salad shooter for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, you were shooting it well on Friday.
Oh, yeah. I was full of ideas. Some of them might actually be good, right?
Yeah, there might be some good ones. Yeah. This next article, it's a podcast. I listened to about half of this podcast. It's about critical feedback, about receiving feedback and giving feedback. And I'm really bad at receiving critical feedback, so I should listen to the rest of this podcast. But I want our anybody who struggles with kind of how to provide feedback to their employees, this is a really good podcast to listen to. They also give you some external links to some other articles and blogs about this. I think it's too hard to get into some of the details in this, but anybody who's wanting to learn a better way to provide feedback to their employees, it was a really good listen, and I think there's some really good resources in here for people to help with that.
Yeah, I think you know, always balancing positive and negative feedback is a strategy that I've used, right? So you tell people where, like, you're doing really good here, and then, you know, in this other area, here's where we can get better. It's always a balance. You never want to go in 100% with, like, nitpicking, because then it feels like you're nitpicking. If it's 100% like negative feedback, not that negative feedback, it's the wrong term for it, right? But if you're like in a corrective kind of mode, having just that, I think, is kind of, it ends up feeling like nitpicking. So you have to have, you know, positive and negative to tell people, I think, give them good direction, right? Keep doing this. This is awesome. And then this, here's some ways to improve here, right?
Yeah. And the first half of the podcast talks about feedback as part of performance evaluations, expectations yep. around promotion and raises, and how to balance that. Because employees are looking for a way to advance their career. You might have very good feedback in certain areas, but other things you want to see them improve before they get promoted. Mm-hmm. And it talks about those balances and how to address those. And I thought that was really good, because a lot of us, you know, in the corporate world are going through performance evaluations. You want to get a raise, but then you've got all this feedback, and it's trying to balance how to effectively receive it, but also give it at the same time, because sometimes it's a two-way street.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Next one, to have a happier home life, treat it a little more like work. It's a great article. You know, my career has been a lot of travel, and it's hard sometimes when you're on the road a lot to balance work and home. It gets difficult, right? You've got, you know, your kids are in school, they have activities, your wife's been home taking care of things for the week. In my situation, this article is actually the reverse of that, by the way. She travels, and he was the stay-at-home dad. And, you know, you're gone and you come home and you're behind in work, but you're also behind at home. Lots of honey-do lists and all these things that have to get done. And what I thought was really good about this article is you take some of the things you do at work, things around organization and communication, apply those at home, and it will actually help create a better home life. And this is something Lauren and I have had to learn over the years. You know, in the early days of traveling, when I was at Qualys and RSA, Tenable, lots of travel, and you had to kind of figure out that balance of, all right, you get home, who's doing what, she needs a break. It takes a while to figure that out, but if you can figure that out, it'll make things so much easier at home. Mm-hmm. Something I've experienced over the years. So it's a good read. Some good tips in here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, your home life and your career balance, and you apply strategies from both, I think, to both situations, right? I mean, Matt, you know, some of our listeners know too, I got a lot going on at home, right? Lots of kids and dogs running around. So we have to be like a well-oiled machine. And sometimes I tell my wife that, I'm like, sometimes we just need more resources. I'm not saying that's the answer every time, right? Sometimes we just got to make sure that, I mean, we both work, so like stuff's got to get done and we have to rely on other people to do that. And it's funny you put the story here, because I was just telling my wife, like, we need to motivate the people that work for us just like you would if you ran a business in security, as an example, right? So we need to make sure that they're properly motivated, compensated, they feel good about their jobs, like the whole thing, because we depend on those people. And we haven't really put much effort into managing some of the people that help us out, right? So
yeah, and outsourcing, right?
Yeah,
you knew you were getting a snowstorm mm-hmm. when you left for RSA, so you outsourced to make sure somebody was going to be there to get the driveway clear for your wife, right?
I got like three people in my phone that I can text, right? And like the first one to get back and commit, like, you got it, dude. Forwarded that to my wife. I'm like, you're all set. And he did, and came and did the snow blowing, and that was because it's weird that there was a big storm, you know, in this time of year. I guess not so weird. We have gotten them, but. Contingency planning is certainly one of those things. If they're not working for you all the time, having someone to pick up those extra resources. We've done that here at Security Weekly, right? When we got overwhelmed with IT a couple of times, you know, I called my friend who does a computer repair shop. It's really good with IT stuff, Linux, Windows, and all the hardware. I'm like, dude, you got to come build some systems, right? It's a short-term contract, comes in, gets you to the next place. And then that's a contingency plan when you're resource constrained. Having those resources lined up in both work and personal is a huge help, especially when you travel, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, I mean, the things we learn. My wife also knows that if she's got something for me to do with the kids, it's got to be on my calendar.
Yeah.
Because if it's not on my calendar, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the kind of things I'm talking about. Is I run my home schedule just like I would my work schedule.
Yep. And work schedule the same way,
it's
right?
A blue calendar item instead of a pink one or whatever that default color is for Security Weekly. But if it's not there, mm-hmm. I don't realize I got to do something like take Brendan to baseball or whatever, right? So I operate those the exact same way.
Absolutely.
Next article, 6 reasons your home office is better than your company office.
Really?
I mean, sometimes, right? Look, I am more efficient at home. Just for me,
Matt, they have a pug and I have 4 pugs. So, I mean, you know, that's a good thing. They're pretty cool. I take them to work sometimes too. So.
That's true, yeah. You know? But I mean, I can focus better. I can be more efficient at home. I can. But there are downsides to being at home in a home office. I mean, that's why I come into studio at least once a month, because, you know, working with the rest of the team in person, continuing mm-hmm. to build the personal relationships, those are some of the downsides of working at home.
Well, I get there's the full bar. A lot of variables, Matt, when you work at home. So I'll give you an example.
Oh, yeah.
We go back from RSA. A lot of us work from home because you're tired from your trip. You got a lot of things to catch up on, right? I mean, and that's been pretty standard. Anytime, especially for us here in Rhode Island, like we had to fly all the way across country, right? So when you get home, a lot of, you know, people work from home and that's fine. And I was on Friday morning and I was watching my 2-year-old and I told my wife, I'm like, that went really well. Like, I was able to like work and do all my stuff and he was chilling out, and if he needed something, I got it, and like it was good. But anyone that has had or has a 2-year-old at home knows the amount of variability there is in there, because I was doing the same thing on Sunday trying to get some house stuff done because we're having a few people over, and it was the opposite. Like, he was not cooperative. He was like, no, you need to sit with me. We need to watch a movie. And we did, and we watched Star Wars, but none of the house stuff got done. And so those working at home really presents a lot more variables, in my opinion, than working from the office. And you just have to be aware of that.
True. And the one thing that was missing in this article, is I can't get cigars at home, so I have to come into the studio to get my cigars.
It's true. Yep. Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, work environments differ. I wanted that in my work environment, so we worked it in here, which is good.
Well, I have a bar in both places, so I have a fully stocked bar at home and at work, so that one transcends regardless. But it's the cigars I miss when I'm not
in the studio. I told you got to build a cigar room.
Next house.
Then we can broadcast from it. It'd be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll work on that one in the next house. Last article for this week. I like to bring in some of the other side, the economic side of this. Cloud economy supports 2.15 million jobs and counting. We talk about this a lot, about cloud computing, the growth of cloud computing. It gets into some very interesting stats on $214 billion to the GDP, you know, 2.15 million jobs. This is where I think we'll continue to see some interesting growth, but also some interesting shortages with good cloud skill sets. And this is something that I know we talk about different skill gaps, but this is one very growing area that I think we're going to continue to see a lot of focus on, and will also drive some very interesting security solutions around as more and more stuff moves into the cloud. So great for a growth perspective, maybe not so good from a skill set perspective.
Yeah, because one of the things I realized recently was that the cloud providers can add so much capability so quickly now because of the infrastructure that they've built. Even when I talk to experts in a particular area and I talk about a new cloud service that's in that area, it's a mix. If they haven't messed around with it, they're like, yeah, I don't. Fargate, I haven't deployed an app in it yet, right? But Lambda, they're like, yes, I have. So while cloud, I think, is way too of the wrong term, it's too far encompassing. You have to find experts in certain areas of cloud. And now there's at least three different major, maybe more, right? If you include some of the other ones that do security, right? I mean, there's obviously Amazon and Azure and Google Cloud, but now there's other cloud platforms, and all of them have their different products. So it's created in a gigantic skills gap that's now highly specialized and not just cloud expert, right?
Yeah, and they're building a lot more services. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk cloud in the early days, it was infrastructure as a service. I take my server from my data center that was virtualized, and I moved it to infrastructure as a service.
Right.
Now we're talking about platform as a service, Lambda, Fargate, these things that are broader platforms that are building out all these services. And Amazon's going crazy with all the different things that they offer. I mean, they're competing with some security companies in solutions they're building. They're building out a lot of new higher end services to go after new emerging areas like industrial IoT and IoT and edge computing. And so, yeah, keeping up with all the things that these cloud providers are launching is, it's hard enough in itself, let alone finding people who know how to use this stuff.
Agree.
Yeah. So that was my wrap for this week, Paul.
Sweet. I liked it. Good stuff.
All right. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.